Hello, I'm Ross Cabbage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And today I have a repeat special guest. So Dr. Rahul Gosain of the Oncology Brothers. Last time we spoke, it was mostly about how you set up the Oncology Brothers kind of medical education platform, but that left so much on the table to compare and contrast community practice with academia. So we thought we'd have another run at it. How are you doing, Rahul?
I'm doing well, Ross. Thank you so much for having me back again. Happy New Year to you and to all your listeners.
So I figured this is almost a kind of like a trading places, kind of walk in their shoes sort of thing. So let's just talk through what a normal week consists of you or kind of a schedule. So, you know, what is Dr. Gosain and how many patients and inpatient coverage and all that jazz?
Yeah, so a little background again. I'm a general community oncologist here in Rochester, New York with the Wilmot Cancer Center. I am at one of the satellite practices, which is not all that different to what a lot of the community practices look like now. That being said, I feel like a lot has changed in the last 10, 15 years from what used to be community, academia, or private practice. A lot of community hospitals have either merged or collaborated with big tertiary coronary centers. For me, a regular day, I'm a generalist. I'm seeing everything and anything. So let's just walk through today. I have 17 patients, and that ranges anywhere between breast cancer to benign hematology to making sure we're following up on a CML patient and talking through someone with mesothelioma. Just the common things that we would see in a general community oncology practice.
And that's 17 patients in a morning or in the whole day?
In a whole day, yeah.
Okay.
Which is actually not terrible.
Yeah.
Which is not when you compare it to other busy private practice or community practices. I know some of my colleagues are seeing somewhere between 20, 25, or even 30 patients a day. My personal practice has always been ranging somewhere between 15 to 20 a day.
And so this brings up a really interesting point. So I train a lot of people, probably 50 to 60% of them go into private practice. And one of the things they're addressed with is these job offers, which is you're going to see this many people per day. So how much control do you have over that? And how much is there a big brother saying, cracking the whip, saying you've got to see more?
You know, I've been lucky in two different places. Prior to coming to University of Rochester, I was in a smaller community practice in Corning, New York. And even then, I had a lot of say on how I want my schedule to be. Granted, after a certain period of time, there is that external pressure saying via RVU or you need to see more patients because there's a long line of patients trying to get in. In Corning, our structure was as such where I had two other APPs working alongside with me. And even though I was seeing about 15 to 20 a day, they both were seeing somewhere between 12 to 15 a day as well. And that was all under, I was overall responsible for that patient population. So in a day, between myself and two nurse practitioners, we're seeing close to 40 to 45. Whereas with the University of Rochester, the model has been a bit better. I still get a chance to take 1 hour for all my new patients, very different than other private community practices. And I get to make my schedule.
One of the things I want to talk about is APPs and, you know, how they're covered and how you address that. I mean, do you go through their lists in advance or are they totally independent and they just touch base with you as needed? Do they bill under your name? I mean, how does your model work?
Yeah, so for us, even back in Corning and here, they bill independently and we run through the list. Every single patient that's coming in and out is someone that we discuss and they usually come up with a plan. Also, having the right person in your team makes a world of a difference. And be it here at University of Rochester or when I was in Corning, I've been blessed to have amazing nurse practitioners. And that's what you want, because at the end of the day, you're taking care of these patients as a team alongside myself, my clinic nurse, and my NP. They bill independently. We run through all our patients together and we plan together. At the end of the day, they're my patients and I want to be involved.
So one of the things, so we really struggled in University of Colorado to get NP salary covered. There was initially a perception is that their billing alone should be enough to cover their salary. And at least in my field of oncology, that was hard. I mean, there were super complex patients, and we eventually found a way that we would sort of, the hospital agreed to sort of cover a proportion of their salary to do it. So were yours self-sustaining, or, I mean, we're getting down into the nitty-gritty here, but that's what you need to do.
Yeah, no, I think that what often we get told by admin versus the reality is very different. I think that it is so tough to hire medical oncologists. So if you're going to stick strictly saying this is the RVU that you're bringing in and your NP is bringing, let's say, half of that volume, we cannot sustain your salary or their salary. I think our pushback has to be, well, it's not just strictly the RVU. We're bringing in a lot more to the table outside just taking care of the patients. We're supplementing your radiology system, radiation oncologists, and so forth. And I really think that more and more hospital systems are buying into this idea. Wait till you have to hire a locum and then you come back on the table saying, yes, no, this approach of having a dedicated medical oncologist that's happy, is doing well, let's make sure they stay with us rather than have them a revolving door.
An ex-CEO of this hospital, you know, as I got to know him, he started to become more honest with me, and including, you know, one of his comments was the physician should never know their true value to the hospital, because one of the games is to tell everyone that they're making a loss. Whereas, like, if they were really making a loss, you wouldn't employ them. But like you say, there's this massive sort of downstream impact because the patient comes in and they have scans and they have blood tests and you refer them to your colleagues. And yeah, I think the billing alone is not enough to pay someone's salary and sort of bring it in. And we had to make that argument for nurse practitioners too. So I actually have a combined list with the nurse practitioner. I put in a plan, I go through it. They still bill independently, but if I go in and, you know, have to dig something out, then we'll co-bill. So, you know, maybe I co-bill on one out of 20 patients or something like that.
Yeah. And again, Russ, I think it's very important for us as physicians to start taking a seat on the table where a lot of these big decisions are made, be it financial, be it admin-wise. I completed my MBA, not to say that, oh my God, MBA is what changed or opened my eyes, but I think it gets your foot in the door saying, all right, I can appreciate the numbers a little better. I can have a different perspective. I think this whole idea of, hey, hiring a physician is a sunk cost and we're paying out of pocket to keep you there is grossly incorrect.
The people who I think really have an eye, and maybe these people are going away, is when there were private practitioners who literally owned their own practice and their own infusion center and their own scanners, because they, you know, everything from soup to nuts sort of came under one person. That's a very specific business-minded physician. Is that, do you think that is going away, or is that still, you know, thriving in some areas?
No, I think that is getting smaller and smaller. And I think that's unfortunate. It's getting smaller and smaller because of how the insurance pays. It's tough to stay afloat now being a private practitioner unless you are part of a larger group and you're merging with other small practices, or there's a private equity backing, which again is a very different conversation. But a standalone private practices are getting very tough to sustain. So that's the reason why you have to partner up with bigger institutions, be it because of your 340B pricing or whatnot.
Explain what 340B pricing is.
So 340B pricing ends up being, if you are a non-for-profit organization, you get this label saying that you can actually get your chemotherapy for a certain price, which if you're a private practice, you cannot sustain. Look at it as a broader wholesaler versus retailer. If you're a private practice medical oncologist, you'll be buying chemotherapy, if you may, at a higher price, and insurance won't let you bill. Let's say it's $90 your buying cost, and you can only bill for $100. Whereas if you're a wholesaler, you're buying that at a lot cheaper price, let's say $50. And on top of it, insurance gives you incentives that you can bill that for $120, $150, $200 at times. So there's a significant premium built into that. So it's tough for you to sustain your overhead costs as a private practice. And I think that that model is getting smaller and smaller. But make an argument. When you're that business, small business owner in this setting as a physician, you're working overtime. You're doing anything and everything to serve your patients, get in at any time. The incentives align there where you're saying, hey, listen, if I get to see this one extra patient from XYZ primary care physician, very likely they'll send me more patients. So now there is that incentive. Let me keep going. Whereas a lot of times in academics or in community settings, our schedules are so tied up saying, hey, I can't see this one more patient. Yes, we all try to make that room for one patient, in this case, small cell lung cancer, who needs treatment right away. But it looks very different in private practice.
Yeah, it's funny because as we were talking about what we were going to discuss in this call, you get into this idea of work-life balance. And one of the things when, so we have a bit where we bring ex-fellows back who've gone on to different jobs, and they sit there, and I remember one, you know, one had gone into academics, one had gone into sort of a Kaiser-type model, and one had gone to like a full-blown private practice. And when they talked about what they enjoyed, you know, people would talk about, you know, the academic freedom or looking after their patients and having work-life balance. And the one who was full-blown private practice was like, I have a house and I have a yacht. And it's kind of like, but are you happy? I mean, we're going to throw some numbers around here, but, you know, do you need to make $800,000 a year? I mean, nowhere, you know, it's not exactly a bad salary if you make half that.
Or Russ, I would think that when we're saying academic freedom, that is also, if we start dissecting, what does that really mean? Is that you sitting and writing grants and working on your last research paper versus someone who is RVU-driven saying, I am not someone who's publishing papers day in, day out. So if that's the case, and if I'm going to sit in front of a screen, I would rather go see another consult. So I don't think that it's about, do you need another paycheck after 800,000? I just think that in academia, we're doing a lot of the groundwork anyhow, but we've convinced ourselves that this is supposed to be my free time, be it publishing another research or being part of another meeting or being part of another committee. All that is coming not at a financial incentive, but at your time. There is that time toxicity, I feel like, associated in academic institutions that we don't appreciate as a physician.
You are spot on. So as I said, you know, the trick is, you know, to convince people that it's a privilege that they work there. And the whole concept of prestige is really a kind of poison chalice. So you will do your academic work in your evenings and weekends, and you'll go to conferences and you'll miss out from your family. And in return, we'll pay you nothing, you know.
No, I think that it's this idea that now that you're part of this prestigious institution, you should be doing all this at your free time. And again, I'm not comparing institutions to one or the other. I think that work-life balance, coming back to the same thing about nurse practitioner, University of Rochester, thankfully, has really bought into this idea. I got my nurse practitioner when I was in this brand new practice. We were still building. I was barely seeing patients at 7 or 8 months of me being here. I was going on paternity leave. I wanted to make sure that my practice, the patient, the small practice at that time, is still taken care of. And we were able to get an NP. And even when my practice and community, ideal community or private settings, would not have paid for that nurse practitioner, at least thankfully they supported that. And to me, that was huge. That brought me that work-life balance. And I really think that we need to have a bigger voice and push for ourselves.
Yeah, let me give you some examples of how we've made moves to try and make that academic prestige thing more remunerated. So it took a while. There was definitely kind of like, you should just be doing this and you should just be thankful. So we now, you know, there's a pool of money which comes back as a kind of, you know, the Department of Medicine takes the WRVU based model and says, we'll give you a certain number of dollars for that. And then we distribute it based on things that we as a department or division decide. And that could be how many papers you write, how many publication, how many grants you have. We use some of it to support the nurse practitioner's salary. And so it's not a perfect model. It's still like, here's a chunk of change. You go figure out how you want to incentivize people. But we have got a little better than you should just do this.
Yeah. And again, coming back to the same idea that incentives have to be aligned. So here, if you have someone who's motivated to do more research and now they are getting reimbursed for their time for attending one more committee or for publishing, I think that is how it should be. This is also this whole debate of, as a journal editor, should you get paid or should you just give in your free time? Because it's a very honorary, very prestigious position. Whereas the publishers, on the other hand, are making tons of money. I really think that as physicians, we've bought into this idea that, and I agree with that, it's a very noble profession. We are in this for the right reason. With that being said, unfortunately, too often someone else is making or have certain, if not always, financial incentives on our working time. That's time away from family. That's time away from our own day in, day out things, especially at the time when we're talking about burnout being so high. There's a huge need of medical oncologists. And I am a huge proponent. Let's keep you where you are rather than us looking for another locum.
Yeah.
Arguably, in small community practices, the care might not be the best because it's a revolving door, because there are so many locums going in and out, and that compromises outcomes. So I think that if you have the right match between the hospital system, the practice you are, the administrative team should do everything to keep you there.
Well, you know, it's funny. We've recently just lost a couple of schedulers, and you start to realize that it's not just about you, no matter, you know, how great you think you are as the physician. It's about the team. And, you know, the scheduler is the front door, and a good scheduler, I mean, you know, they should find a way of like paying them more to keep these people here as opposed to this revolving door, like you say, and you just go, okay, now we'll have to just train someone. It's not a spigot. You can't just turn on talented people and turn it off again.
Yeah, no, I think that, so I'm the medical director of the community site I'm at. I also overlook 14 other infusion sites. And it is so important. It's not just us as physicians, providers, APP. It's teamwork, be it your front desk, be it your nurses, nurse managers, practice managers. And when the patient's walking in or when they're walking out, that front desk is that impression, that cheerful face saying, hey, welcome, or saying a patient and reading that right body language saying, looks like they had a conversation, first time talking about cancer or hospice. Just giving that a little more empathy, saying, let us know how we can help, makes a world of a difference.
Yeah, there's the other thing I try and do is I try to make sure that I know every member of staff and I know, you know, about them and what's going on in their lives, because they, you know, the patient is going, well, you know, what's Dr. Ghassan like, you know, when they're, you know, making that first appointment. But I just think that, you know, you have to make everyone feel like they're a member of the team. Okay, let's talk a wee bit about burnout. So I think you've actually done some work on burnout, but what drives it? Do we know what, I mean, maybe it's obvious, but is burnout work-life balance, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, no, I wish we knew what drives burnout. I think it is very complicated. There's so many different facets to it. We continue to see just this whole idea of dissatisfaction or overwork in our field, just in medicine in general. Medical oncology also continues to be in top tier for burnout year after year. I don't have a good answer if we know what's driving it. That being said, I do think that this should be part of a conversation coming back to the same thing. Can we keep our team happy? It's whenever I'm talking to my front desk, NPs, myself, and we often say patient first. Well, no, let's take a step back. Let's focus on you so that if you're happy, I really think that the patient's going to be taken care of.
Yeah.
So that also plays a role in burnout, where you are having some sort of support, be it family support, emotional support. I think all that plays a role. And what we do is demanding. It's challenging. It's emotionally challenging. It's tough.
We just want to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves and each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, and maybe this is super simplistic, is the person's challenges are witnessed. You see that somebody's had a bad day and they put in the extra mile, and you don't just go, yeah, you know, it's a normal Wednesday, so what? You say, you're amazing, and we couldn't have done this without you, and you made that extra mile, and we value you. And it works both ways. I mean, I think we all feel better with a little pat on the back, you know, not kind of like feed me compliments, but just being witnessed and being seen.
Ross, it again reiterates the idea that it's important for us to have a seat on the table, because more often than not, from the leadership or administrative side of things, we often hear about this also on social media. Ends up being for Doctor's Day or something more important, you have free pizza for your whole staff. Rather than, again, taking that step, knowing that team, knowing them personally, and taking the time to appreciate them. That goes whole far more than a piece of cookie or a free pizza that day.
Yeah, free pizza is almost kind of an insult. It's like, dude, that's all you can do. In a prior administration, as I got to know them, I would invite various senior members down to spend half a day in the clinic with me. And that helped, you know, walk in the shoes of the other. And similarly, as, you know, as I got a seat in the C-suite for certain committees, you know, that helped me understand where they were coming from too. But as these organizations merge and fuse, you know, I think the leadership gets further away from the troops.
Yeah, I think I've not done that, but where I am, we do have, so I'm a generalist, and there are a few other specialists that come out. We have a thoracic medical oncologist, lymphoma person who happens to be our chair of the department who comes out to this site. Then we have a GI medical oncologist who comes out. So I think having the leadership being present and being involved and knowing them personally makes a world of a difference.
How do you thread that needle with being a generalist and then with specialists in the same organization, or even if they're in a different organization? You know, how do you peer that attention? Because you don't want to de-skill, send everything to the other guy, but equally, you have to recognize they have a certain skills too.
Yeah, I think it's a win-win situation here. Unfortunately, there's so much cancer that everyone's busy. It would be very different if we were all fighting, saying, I'm sitting here twiddling thumbs and I've not seen a patient in 3 months, whereas XYZ is so busy. So I think we're all busy enough that there is spillover. My lymphoma or GI medical oncologist cannot keep up with all the pancreatic cancer or diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that's coming through the door. But then it also gives me a chance to tap into them saying, hey, this patient has progressed through first line. The disease is active. What would you do? So the onus is on me in that settings to make sure that they're still getting the best care that they would with this lymphoma person. So I think in this particular unique setup, our patients are better taken care of, and we still all are relatively busy.
So you're now as part of the University of Rochester, but when you were more a standalone private practitioner, how did you react to kind of people going for second opinions? So my experience is generally being good, but you know, there are something like, there's a defined number, 200 or something, maybe more, private practitioners in Colorado. And lung cancer is common. And yet the ones who send patients to me for a second opinion is not all of those people. And yet I know they're seeing lung cancer. And so maybe they're sending them somewhere else, but I do believe there are some people when the patient has driven the second opinion who are holding on to the patient. And whilst I would love to say that was because they were fantastically competent, I worry that just occasionally it's just because they're saying this is my income stream.
So how do I feel about it? First year or two when I was just starting my practice, I used to love getting second opinions because it was not so for the patient. It was more so a pat on my back saying, all right, thankfully I'm doing the right thing.
Oh, good.
I was a solo practitioner. So as we all remember, just that first few patients in our first month or two being an attending was like overwhelming. But on a serious note, I do think that second, third opinions should be encouraged.
We're all in this together. Coming back to this idea of, hey, that's my income stream, I would think that's getting smaller and smaller. Because a lot of times, if I send my patient to Ross Kemmage because he has this clinical trial, sooner than later, this patient still wants to come back home. They want that treatment close to home. And I think it's a two-way street. Very likely, sooner than later, Ross will send me a patient saying, hey, this patient lives closer to you and is getting the same carbopemetrexate or carbopempembro that I would give here. Can you take care of this patient closer to home? Know that I'm available if things change. So I don't know. I've not had that experience where you send someone to one practice and they're holding on to them, or the other way around where people are reluctant. Even when I was in a smaller practice, again, there was no close tertiary coronary center. The closest was University of Rochester, and that was 2.5, 3 hours away.
Yeah.
And in that scenario, it made no sense for either of us to hold on to a patient if they were closer to one or the other center, saying, no, you should be treated here or there. I think that we all continue to learn from each other. I think it gets tough when it's difference of opinion, saying I would do this or I would do that. And in that settings, I think the easiest way is to jump on a phone call and just share the data or your thought process and make sure that we're discussing through the nuances.
Do you know, it's funny. I think the issue with anecdotes of, you know, bad experiences is you don't have a denominator. You don't count all the times when it went well, but you do remember the times when, you know, you sort of go, you know, this person is really doing things wrong and you should run, not walk away from them. And that happens incredibly rarely, but it sticks in your mind. And
absolutely.
You know, we, you know, bad experiences included, because I have to get them out of my, I have to sort of vent here, is, you know, the patient coming for a clinical trial and the private practitioner insists on giving one cycle of chemotherapy just before you go so that they've kind of quote unquote set the hook and they have to bring them back. Radiation oncologists who give hyperfractionated regimes when you don't need to, 16 fractions for the bone mat. You go, why? And these things, it's weird. Like you said, the incentives have to align, but they have to align with having the patient at the center of it. And if you get to the point when you go, I have two choices, A or B, and they're both good for the patient. A is more convenient for the patient, but B makes me more money. And if you get to that question, you're entering burnout. You've lost your focus.
Yeah, and Ross, I wonder how frequently this
I don't think it's frequent. That's the problem, is I just remember it, and it's such an affront when you see it so blatant. But you're right. We'll see. It's like 1 in 1,000 consults.
And even then, that's one more than it should happen. I completely agree with that. But I'm just wondering here, thinking if someone got that hyperfractionated radiation, was that more so because they did not know any better? Could SBRT be available? Maybe they don't have SBRT.
Well, I love the generosity of your spirit, but no, I trained as a radiation oncologist originally, and that is no, there's nothing there. And it was like, I remember it was like it wasn't even an old person. It was like a young, fit person. And it was clearly a maximum billing thing. And like you say, these things are incredibly rare. Yeah.
Yeah. But again, that should just not happen, period. I don't think there's any other side to this. If that's the case, that's grossly wrong and that should not happen. But where I am today in terms of in the midst of community, academia, trying to bridge this gap, even with oncology brothers, I think that both sides want to do best, not need to, they want to do best. When I'm leaning into my academic colleagues, they're more than willing to help, be it in my own institution or when I'm just sending blank emails to like first author saying, hey, can you walk me through the study design or what were you thinking or would this patient fall into this category? Or the community oncologist acknowledging that I don't know everything. I cannot appreciate all the nuances. This field is moving too fast and I need to tap into my academic colleagues. So I've had majority of my experience has been very positive saying we want to do the best on both sides.
And I think that is becoming more common. Maybe as people move away from this kind of like, you know, soup to nuts, I own everything bit, where, you know, the inappropriate incentive to give infusions, to give PET scans just because you own the scanner. And I'll tell you a small anecdote. So as part of my training, I spent 18 months at AstraZeneca. And when they first developed Iressa, the single most common question they got asked in the USA is there an IV formulation? The simple reason that the reimbursement for the physician would be more than a pill. And that's not made up. That's true. But again, maybe that's a 20-year-old model and we're heading in a better direction.
Yeah, and I think that when I was talking about private practice and this whole idea of 340B and so forth, I feel like some of the changes or challenges have been because of stuff like this. And that now in the hospital, bigger community settings, I would like to be optimistic and think that we've moved away from that. But a very different argument now, specialty pharmacy oral drugs are so expensive. And I don't know where the money stream goes there, but I do think that, again, we need to be more financially educated to do better for our patients.
Do you have to cover inpatients?
Oh, I don't. As part of our contract, the community practices take calls for each other on the weekends, but we don't do inpatient at this time.
In your prior job, did you have to do inpatient coverage?
Yeah, so that was, again, spread out through. I was in a small hospital, which was a 60-bed hospital, and then we're just a attached cancer center. So I was taking consults, which were not a heavy consult burden, but on the weekends we were doing inpatient, and that was one every fourth weekend, so I did do inpatient at that time.
You know, I would much rather have you as the inpatient consult service than me, because it's like the one time when it's like, oh, so I'm like so super specialized. It's like, oh, a bowel cancer. What do you do with that? And fortunately, we depend on the generalist training of our juniors in this academic setting. And unfortunately, we now have hospitalists too. But yeah, there's this sort of weird bit where we try and force this square peg into a round hole.
You know, so we've started doing something here with the University of Rochester. We actually just partnered up with a smaller site, which is 3-4 hours away, with telemedicine. And that was the idea, that can we provide some inpatient coverage to them? And while we were doing that, when we were chit-chatting with our leadership, that was the idea, that let's see if we can tap into us as generalists, because I do agree that I would better serve someone who's coming in with some sort of hemophilia, or now, hey, we're worried about platelet counts, but they also have history of breast cancer and now they're dealing with lung cancer or whatever it may be. And every single patient that you go through is presenting with something different. Of course, yes, the primary medical oncologist should be involved and so forth. But if there is something that I'm saying, all right, get a biopsy of this site, this is hormone receptor positive breast cancer, this person does not need chemotherapy right this minute, we can start on endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitors in outpatient settings, I can make that clinical decision. Whereas a lung cancer or a medical oncologist that's focusing on thoracic, I think that ends up being a little tough.
Yeah, no, I can take that blow. It's well deserved. Let's talk a little bit about how do you maintain interest. I remember speaking to a guy called Tony Mok, who's a well-known thoracic oncologist from Hong Kong. And previously, he'd been a private practitioner in an area around Toronto and Canada. And his argument for leaving private practice and going back to academia was that he knew exactly what he was going to be doing in 5 years and 10 years and 15 years, and it would look very much the same. So how do you keep yourself fresh and interested?
Yeah, I make that counter argument. I don't know what I'll be doing in that spot.
There you go.
I really, if you asked me 10 years ago when I was doing my fellowship, would I be out in a small community practice and then be part of a larger academic institution, but be in their satellite clinic rather than at the mothership? The answer would have been no. It would have looked very different. I wanted to go do BMT part of my training. Then I said, no, I want to focus on thoracic medical oncology. Ended up in community settings because of my J1 and my wife did her residency close by. So I don't know what next 5, 10, 15 years are going to look like. And I think as a general medical oncologist, there's so much happening, but we're back to where we started. We're seeing a lot of bucket approvals. We're seeing that, hey, now we can use T-DXd in breast cancer and lung cancer, and we can also use it in pancreatic cancer. Response rate is very low in pancreatic cancer for T-DXd. Side note. But again, we're able to connect those dots. Am I going to be someone who can appreciate very minute nuances of every clinical trial? Absolutely not. That's why I need to tap into my academic colleagues. But I think as a general medical oncologist, things are very exciting. There is so much happening. And we get a chance to do this and appreciate all the wins for our patients, be it lung cancer, and now you have osimertinib as a LORA trial, or enfortumab for bladder cancer has doubled the overall survival. I get to see it all.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things you actually do is you do the Oncology Brothers. I mean, and so that your passion comes through there for staying up to date. That's and cool. For doing a service to the community, to getting that out there. And you do an amazing job. You and your brother do an amazing job. One question, of course, is will human knowledge in oncology be ever too much for a generalist? Or maybe it's like, well, it doesn't matter. There are enough oncologists to go around. You have to have generalists. I mean, do you see any pressure even within community to have some degree of specialization just to limit the data flow?
Absolutely. There should be a need because there's so much happening. But coming back to what you brought up, the need is as such that today 70% of our patients get treated out in the community settings. And despite that, there's a huge shortage of medical oncologists. I do think that just looking at the supply and demand, there's always going to be a need for a generalist. I would love to see everyone pick some micro focuses or just being a specialist. I just worry that the need is as such that generalist will always be in demand.
Yeah. How many days a week do you do clinic?
4.
Okay. When's your admin day? You know,
project.
That's rather convenient.
Yeah. So thankfully, I was able to negotiate that as well, because at that time I was doing my MBA, which was in Baltimore. So I had to travel some back and forth. But now that I'm all done with my MBA, it ends up being rather very convenient.
So if I was a new grad and I come out and I join your group, what advice would you give me in terms of, you know, what should I negotiate with you? Or is it just kind of like, it is what it is?
Yeah. Even before coming out to negotiate, I strongly encourage fellows to take some time and do a rotation out in the community. I think it looks very different than when you're going from a breast cancer clinic to thoracic to GI. I really, really strongly encourage fellows to take some time to do dedicated time out in the community. And if you've gone through that in terms of negotiation, my program director from Louisville, Dr. Cloker, always used to say, you know why 80, 90% of the people don't get what they want is because they did not ask for it.
Ooh.
Ask for it. Worst case scenario, someone in my position will say no, or at least I'll walk away saying, huh, that's a good thought. As simple as asking for a 4-day work week, or, hey, if I am going to be working here, when do I get my nurse practitioner? What kind of support can I expect? Are there other physicians that are coming to this practice? What's the turnover rate? Not just between the physicians, but the APPs and nurses. It gives you an idea of what the work culture is. Always ask upfront what my salary is going to look like. I feel like there's a taboo to talk about money when it comes to medicine, going back to the same idea of at times admin does not want you to appreciate your worth that you bring in. So I think that you're better off asking for something that's important to you. It has to be a two-way street. As a resident, as a fellowship, you're not in the driving position. You're always waiting for that match and hoping that you'll get somewhere. Now, the tables have turned. You are in demand. You want to be in a place that you're going to be happy, and you want to look at it as long-term. Even if you're not going to be there as long-term, you want to make sure that you look at yourself and say, am I going to be happy in this work environment, be it salary, the people I'm working with, work-life balance, the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, you got to play the long game. And one of the things I tell the fellows is that your life story only makes sense when you look at it in retrospect. You know, at the time, it's kind of like, I have no, this is total chaos. I don't know what's going on. You go, oh, that's why I did that.
Yeah. And that's the reason, if you were to ask me, what about next 5, 10 years? I don't know. However, when we're looking back in time and connecting dots, it seems also surreal and easy.
Yeah.
Ross, we've taken some time to appreciate what I would tell a new grad for community settings. What would be your advice to someone who's looking for a position in your institution, an academic institution?
So that's a great question. So some of it is very similar. Some of it is, if you want to be an academic, they have to give you the tools to be successful and understanding the motivation of the different people who are signing your job offer. You know, maybe the hospital, if it's a split hospital university, just wants you to see a ton of patients. But at some point, you know, you have to have that protected time. So the classic thing is, they say, we want you to do 4 half-days a week in clinic, but we want you to do it on 4 separate days. And you go, that's 4 days in clinic, you know. So you want to make sure that your half-days are combined into full days. You want to look at the level of protection during those other times. If you're the sole practitioner, there's no way your non-clinic days are going to be protected. You need the NP. You need colleagues. People talk a lot about mentorship, and I've sort of gone on the record saying that the best mentor is actually you, because sometimes you get a great mentor and sometimes you don't. And if you don't, that's not the end of your career. So I think going in, finding a mentor, even if they're not in your institution, and people want to help, and just sort of like I had a fellow who wrote a paper the first time, and I said, are you going to include your middle initial? And he was like, well, why would I do that? Because you're going to write more than one paper and you have a common name. You know, so J. Smith is not enough. And he's like, oh, no one ever told me that. So I think go in, just like you say, ask for what you want. You're not always in the best negotiating position when you're coming in as an instructor or assistant professor. And the job that pays you a little bit more may be paying you more because they're trying to sweeten some kind of bitter pill. So trying to figure out what you want. If you want to be academically successful, you've got to have protective time, but you've got to be a good team player. You can't say, oh yeah, I don't want to work Mondays or Fridays and I don't want to work weekends. Like, well, suck it up. Other people have a life too. But yeah, I love the conversation, the similarities and the differences between community and academia. And talking to someone like you, it actually encourages me. And I feel like we are all in it together and things are getting better. So Rahul, I'm going to wrap this up. It is always great to talk to you. You're a fantastic guy. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Sir, thank you for having me. It's always fun talking to you.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at DR Kamage on X for additional commentary.